Welcome to Crosstalk. Thank you so much for joining us. I am so excited to be sharing my friend Mike's story. We call him Irish Mike. Please don't forget to like and subscribe if you like it. Subscribe if you do. That helps us. We are a nonprofit, a 501(c). Our goal is to eventually be able to give scholarships and get people help in some way. So, you know, we're not affiliated with any specific place or anything. We just want to help people, and that's our goal. So thank you for tuning in. And Mike, thank you so much for being here.
It's a pleasure.
So basically here on Crosstalk, you know, we kind of, you know, go through your story. Like, where did it all begin? I mean, you know, what was your childhood like? What happened? When did you start drinking? You know, what did it look like? When did you get help? What did that look like, type
right,
of thing?
Right, right.
So take it away.
Yeah, well, a little bit about my background. I did grow up near the Fordham Road section of the Bronx. Mm-hmm. And this was back in the 60s and 70s when it was predominantly like a working class neighborhood. Mm-hmm. You know, the funny thing about when you do get sober is it allows you to connect a lot of dots that I did not connect at that time. Mm-hmm. And what I look back on is I felt as though, unfortunately, because of, I do believe in genetics, I do believe that I was doomed.
From the start.
I was doomed.
Yeah, they say Irish people like to drink.
Yeah, a little bit. And this neighborhood was, at the time, was predominantly Irish, Italian, and Jewish. Pretty common, typical New York City neighborhood at that time. And I loved my childhood. I had a great time. I had a lot of fun, had a lot of friends. It was a very ethnic kind of, there was those three major cultures that were going on at once. And some of these houses, you know, you've walked into a friend's house, English was not the primary language. Right. They'd be speaking Italian. They were speaking Yiddish, you know. So it was very much, these were post-World War II families, you know, parents that had been through the, through World War II, that were raising their children predominantly, a lot of, the Bronx is made up of a lot of churches and a lot of neighborhood bars. Okay. My Uncle Tommy owned a bar in the neighborhood. So, you know, that was a focal point from a very early point. I mean, the baby carriages were outside the bar on Sunday. You know, you go to church, and then it was like, okay, we go to the bar. So, unfortunately, what I look back on is that it was actually, unfortunately, it was a culture of alcoholism from the very get-go. I didn't realize it at that time.
Yeah.
It hadn't affected me yet. But my mother had five brothers, and one was worse than the next. These were all guys who worked for the city, Mass Transit Authority. My Uncle Jimmy, had an Uncle Jimmy who drove a bus in the city. And he was a bad drunk. Jimmy was a bad drunk.
Right.
And driving the city bus, you know, after a while, he started smacking into things. It was a little bit of a problem.
Yeah.
And they finally said to him, they said, Jimmy, look, because back then the cops covered for you. Nobody got arrested, really, for drunk driving.
Right.
The cops covered for you. And they said,
well, they covered for you if you knew them.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Right, and he knew them.
Right.
They drank in the same bars, you know, a lot of them. So they'd said to, finally, the suits came down, management came down, and they said, Jimmy, look, you cannot drink and drive a city bus. We can't have it, okay? Now, you got to do something about it. And he said, all right, I'll stop driving.
Wow.
That was the solution. I'll stop driving, because I'm certainly not going to stop drinking.
Right.
You know, that's out of the question. You
right.
know? So it was
at
that
least he
kind
was honest
of,
with himself.
Yeah. It was that kind of culture that I grew up in.
So he changed his lifestyle, which I did a lot to, you know, work around what he loved to do most, which
right.
is
it was drink.
Drink.
Drink. And what they do with the, you know, a lot of the MTA day people, if you can't, if you're unwilling to stop drinking and driving, then you go to work in the terminal.
Okay.
Sweeping up and thing. They get you like, they'll get you off the road one way or the other.
Right.
You know, but to save his pension and everything, they said, all right, you'll work in the terminal. So it was those kinds of, you know, that. Now, I didn't realize that at the time, but as I look back in sobriety, I said, wow, you know, this thing started way before I picked up a drink.
Right.
So the attitude really, the rationalization was that you work hard You absolutely drink hard. There's right. no question about it. You work hard, you drink. You bring home a paycheck. And a lot of moms back then, they didn't work.
Right.
They were raising babies.
Yeah.
So when they talk about, you know, like in AA, when they talk about taking hostages,
yeah.
they were hostages.
Right.
Because where are they going?
I shouldn't be laughing, but it's true.
It's, you know, it's kind of funny, but sad at the same time, yeah, you know, yeah. that they were hostage to, because he brought home the paycheck.
Right.
So this is what I learned. And, you know, my mother was the type of girl, when her brothers got married, she said to them, she goes, look, I'm not leaving my kids with a babysitter. They're coming to the wedding.
Yeah.
They're coming to your wedding. So we went to this wedding at a place called Alex and Henry's. It was south of Fordham Road near Tremont Avenue. And it was a catering place. Everyone got married there from that neighborhood. So we go to this wedding. And it started out, you know, nice. You know, people were, you know, hello, how do you do?
Cordial.
Nice and cordial. Right. How do you do? That's everything. And back then, they kept the bottles on the table. There was no rolling bar. There was no bar to go to.
Yeah.
They kept the bottles on the table.
I've been to places that have that.
Right. This is old school, yeah. you know, the whiskey and the vodka. It's all within arm's reach. So things started to deteriorate. And somebody must have said something to somebody about their wife or girlfriend. Next thing you know, tables are getting flipped. Tables are flipped and bottles are flying like a Wild West saloon. And, you know, I was six. At the time, it was the most frightening thing I'd ever seen in my life, you know, to see adults out of control.
Right.
So that was alcoholism. Didn't realize it, but it was one of the effects that I saw. They were scared. These were scary guys. There were some scary guys there.
Yeah.
So I didn't even want them invited to the house. My mother would say, my cousin Pat's coming up. What'd you invite him for? Why does he have to come over?
Right,
he was
right.
Another. So you grow up in this kind of environment where, you know, the alcohol is ever present. But you don't know what's ahead for you. And I'll be the first to say, you know, between Hampton Bays and the Jersey Shore and all the clubs in the city, and I've been to all those clubs in the city, Limelight and the Red Parrot.
Oh, my God, I can't even imagine.
Oh, yeah, and Studio 54, it's right. the second edition of Studio 54, the Red Parrot, Limelight, and, you know, there's a bunch of others, too. And so, you know, and it was a lot of fun. It was a good time.
Yeah.
But, you know, unfortunately, there's a nasty little word in recovery that we talk when we talk about alcoholism, which is progression.
Right.
You know, you don't realize because you're so focused on what alcohol does for you as the social lubricant. And you're not aware of what it's actually doing to you.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, my progression was very methodical. It was a methodical progression all through my 20s, having a great time. Moved out to Long Island and did all the clubs out there, Zachary's and Uncle Sam's and Metro
right.
700
oh my, yeah.
and Channel 80 and, you know, Sprats and, you know, out in the Hampton Bays with
you're
OBI.
Like a true New Yorker.
Yeah, for sure.
The whole,
for
yeah,
sure. The
okay.
whole, that whole New York.
The circuit.
Neighborhood culture. It was a neighborhood. Which is really, growing up in a neighborhood is like growing up in a small town.
Right.
Because everyone certainly knew my mother. Because my mother she was a nurse. She worked a lot of the hospitals in the Bronx. And she knew the kind of people I was hanging out with, you know. So she wasn't a fan. She, you know, she wanted to see, this is back in the 70s, she wanted to see crew cuts and blazers, not long hair and leather.
Right.
Not a fan. Not a fan of the music either.
So when did you start, like, what was your first drink?
Well, my first drink was just very innocent in the playground, you know, just hanging out in the playground. We'll listen to Led Zeppelin and Black Sabbath and Jethro Tull. And, you know, we're drinking Schaefer beer, you
right.
know. And
how old were you?
Probably, I would say right there, about 14.
Okay.
About 14 years old. That's when it all kind of really started. And then, and like I said, we were just having a great time and, you know, did what I had to do. You know, I went to Catholic schools all the way, you know, Catholic elementary, high school. And then I didn't go to Notre Dame. I didn't have the grades to get
right.
in, but I went to Fordham. I went
okay.
to Fordham, just right on Fordham.
It's a good
Road
school.
There. Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. But, you know, my drinking, I can say definitely in college, you know, for, I'm sure a lot of people, you know, who end up watching this or listening to this podcast, you know, your college years, and that's when Animal House came out. the movie Animal House came out. And that was, you know, although that was theoretically, that was in 1963 when that film took, you know, when they, that period, really a period piece around 1963. In 1978, it was the same deal. I mean, we, as a result of that movie, we actually started having toga parties. So, you know, in college, things definitely, you know, really started to get a little out of hand. But, you know, it wasn't, you know, I wasn't drinking in the morning. And that's a, you know, that's a big rationalization.
Yeah.
People say, well, I don't drink in the morning. You know, absolutely. I drink in the afternoon, right, maybe if I go to the beach, and then obviously at night. But I broke that barrier too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I used to have so many, I was like, oh, I don't keep it in my apartment.
Right.
For years. I lived in New York. I didn't need to. You know what I mean? Like wherever I turn, there's alcohol.
Right.
But of course, those rationalizations are so funny. You know, I think back and... we say the funniest things, so ridiculous to other people who don't have an allergy, don't have a problem.
It's like keeping your job. You know, if you're able to keep your job, you know, and I remember that term when I got to, when I got to AA, it's, people would say, well, you know, I'm going to these meetings, but I'm a functional alcoholic, just functional alcoholic. And they, the old timers turned to me and said, hey, Mike, that's a drunk with a job.
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, that's not like a separate category.
Right. You're just still a drunk.
You're just a drunk with a job.
Yeah.
You know, so that was, and, you know, I talk about this a lot when I speak to, you know, at a, when I speak at a meeting, is that when you do get sober eventually, people talk about a spiritual awakening. I told a newcomer, like, don't worry about the spiritual awakening. That's going to happen down the road. Mm-hmm. Worry about the rude awakening, because that's coming through the door first. The rude awakening.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, you're coming out of a coma. And I remember looking at myself in the bathroom and saying, because I was good at blaming other people, you know, low-hanging fruit, easy targets. Well, if you were married to who I was married to, or, you know, if you had my parents, or if you had my in-laws, or if you had my friends growing, or if you grew up in the neighborhood I grew up in, you know, it was easy to deflect and point the finger. And
play the, I'm Irish. That's like number one.
Or play the victim role.
Yeah.
You know, play the victim role. But, you know, thank God for the old-timers, because they just weren't going to let me get away with the alibis and excuses.
Yeah.
They weren't going to let me point the finger at everyone else. You know, I had to look in the mirror and say, I did this. I wrecked my life with my use and abuse of alcohol, the physical addiction to alcohol. And I would say, my, you know, my lowest point was, you know, I moved out to Long Island. I got married, a nice girl.
Is this after college?
Yeah, after college. Had a, eventually, you know, we had a, had a daughter. And I remember when I started drinking in the morning, when the, when it goes from the social lubricant to self-medication, alcohol, self-medicating with alcohol. And I remember that feeling of opening my eyes in the morning and shaking out of my skin. And my heart, it was more than anxiety. It was a state of terror. I was terror-stricken from the withdrawal symptoms of alcohol. I couldn't bring any alcohol in the house. That was already, like, forbidden.
Right.
No booze in the house. Yeah. So my car, besides a car, was also a rolling liquor cabinet.
Wow.
And I didn't walk. I ran down to that car. I ran to that car at 6 o'clock in the morning to get my hands on that vodka.
Yeah.
Or if there was no vodka or whiskey or any other type of alcohol, then I would go to CVS and get a large bottle of Listerine.
No way, you did?
Listerine is 26% alcohol. It was at the time anyway.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you're so physically addicted that, you know, you'll drink it, you'll drink gasoline if it'll get you, you know, if it'll get you drunk. That's when you are fully in the grip. It's really a death grip. You know, the grip of alcoholism around your throat, where it's not a question of like, gee, you shouldn't drink. I have to drink.
Right.
It's an absolute, I have to drink. So that's when you, I think you're truly screwed. You know, you're just, and I, you know, the thing about it was I tried to pass myself off as like a good husband and a father. Because my game, the game I played would be like on Saturday morning after I'm, you know, pretty, I'm pretty high at this time now.
Yeah.
If you were my neighbor, And I made sure you saw me. You'd see me at 10 o'clock in the morning with the groceries in one hand and dry cleaning in the other. And, oh, hi, Mrs. How are you doing? Good morning. How are you? How's everything? Because I wanted to make my wife look crazy. So that if they later, if they saw Randy, that was her name, Randy, and said, hey, Randy, we saw Michael with the dry cleaning and the what a great guy. What a wonderful guy you're married to.
Your hostage. You gotta keep your hostage hot and hostage.
But no, Randy got so fed up, she goes, who, Michael? Yeah, he's a real prince. Why don't you stop by today about 3 o'clock? I'll show you what the prince is up to. He'll be easy to find. Just look underneath the coffee table, you know.
Right.
She was fed up trying to cover for me.
Yeah.
No more covering.
Right.
You know, now she wanted me to be exposed.
At what age
was this? I was probably at this time, I was about late 30s.
Okay.
30, 38.
So what I call like that switch from like when alcohol is like, you know, for fun and the social lubricant and
right.
switching to that like medicated state
right.
where you have to drink in the morning or whatever time it may be for
right.
you. I call that crossing that invisible line. I'll
yeah.
never forget when I crossed the invisible line. It was like late morning. I went to my brother's and I slammed a glass of wine on his coffee table and I go, yeah, okay, I'm an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. And that's literally what I said to him. And he just like gave me these lists. Look, and he was just like scared almost because I didn't care.
Right, horrified.
I was yeah. like, I am owning this and I'm proud of it almost. Like, call me crazy, I don't care, call me insane. And I call that crossing the invisible line. So at what age did you cross that invisible line?
I would say probably about 30, 31.
Okay.
30, early 30s.
Early, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, I don't recommend people letting it get that far out of hand. And I still was not going to voluntarily come to AA. It had to be some pretty intense consequences. It's just like my story is just like something you read out of the big book. You
yeah.
know, I've done the jails, I've done the institutions. I remember I was at a meeting once, and they were talking about yets.
Yeah.
Oh, I haven't been to prison yet, and I haven't been homeless yet, and I haven't done this yet. I said to them, I said, you know what? I understand about the yes. I don't want the agains. I don't want back in jail again, back in detox again, out of the house again, no license again, no car again, no job again.
Right.
The agains were bad enough. We all have yes, you know, jails, institutions, death. You know,
yeah, but, of course.
And
the
I came,
ultimate,
you know,
the ultimate,
in the second
yes.
step, it says, you know, we came to believe. And I came to believe that what these old timers were telling me was the truth.
Yeah. So what happened? So you're coming home, you're with the dry cleaning, you know, with all
just,
the
it's
playing the facade.
Complete scam. A
yeah.
Complete facade, right.
And did your wife kick you out? Like, what was the culminating?
The culminating factor was just, you know, it was another. My wife was out of town,
mm-hmm.
so I'm taking care of
late
my
30s.
Daughter. Yeah, my daughter was at doing a sleepover at her friend's house. So I was home alone, pretty drunk, and I decided, I'm going to go out. You know, I'm going to go out. It's like midnight. And I was in a neighborhood that I shouldn't have been in because I stuck out like a sore thumb.
Right.
And you know, I got pulled over. And arrested. It was my second drunk driving arrest. Now my ex-wife, my wife at the time was out of town. She was in Colorado skiing.
Yeah.
And word got back to her that this is what happened. You know, daughter's okay. She's at a sleepover, but
he's been arrested again.
He's been arrested. You know, so she took the next flight out, got back home. And she didn't start screaming. It was a look of resignation. She was just resigned to the fact that he's not going to get better. You know, I mean, I did start going to AA meetings. I was going to them drunk. I was going to AA meetings drunk.
Yeah.
And then I met anybody who's been around a while. They'll say, I went to AA. It was not doing great. It was okay. But then I met somebody. Pivotal moment.
Right.
Pivotal moment when you meet somebody, that when you meet that person. And for me, it was a guy named John Keel. John doesn't care about using his last name. He's still up on Long Island. How he got my wife's number, I have no clue. But he called her up and he said, "How you doing?" She said, "Great, John." He goes, "Mike's going to meetings." He goes, "Yeah, that's." He goes to meetings. He goes there drunk. Now the next time he goes to detox, because that's coming.
Yeah.
He can't just come back home and say it's business as usual. Gee, honey, what's for dinner? He needs to go directly up to treatment. He can't be trusted with his freedom.
Yeah.
So he needs to go from detox directly to treatment. And that's what happened. You know, I went.
So originally you got arrested and then you started going to meetings.
Yeah.
No treatment.
And doing the Nassau County drunk driver program, you know.
Right,
with
right.
The community service and, you know, the probation and all that stuff.
Which wasn't attorney. Working, obviously.
Yeah, not working.
Right. Oh, not I had working. A good attorney, too. But in the inevitably, I ended up in Florida, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So this guy has the gall and the, you know, actually, he cares about you to call your wife.
He said, "The nerve, have you called my wife?"
I know. I would have killed him at the time.
Oh, my God. But so I went to this place, and it's a treatment center up in Kerhonson, New York.
God, I don't even know where that could be.
It was a place called Veritas Villa. And at that time, this is in 1999. I got sober May 10th, 1999. So I'm up there at Veritas Villa. Veritas Villa, New York City sends all of their police, fire department, okay. MTA workers, Con Ed sends their people up there. And the Archdiocese of New York sends their priests.
Right.
Up there as well. I saw the priest up there. I said, "What are you guys doing here?" They said, "Well, you know, Mike, we're really good at our job, but we can't stop drinking, you know."
That's so funny.
Hilarious. You know? So, and that was a game changer, Veritas Villa, an absolute game changer, because it's all 12-step based, you know, AA all the way.
I wonder if it's still around.
I think not anymore. I think it closed a couple of years, maybe 4 or 5 years ago.
Oh, okay.
It had been there for a long time, a good over 30 years probably. And they do great work up there. I mean, it was a lifesaver, really.
Yeah.
And then when I got back down to Long Island, John said, "You know, I'm saving you a seat in AA. You need to." And by the way, Mike, you need to start going to early morning AA, because you certainly drank in the morning.
Yeah.
You need, upon awakening, you need to go to an AA meeting. These weren't suggestions. These were like, you know.
You got
to
go.
It was like playing sports. You have a position coach. And, you know, he's going to tell you what you need to do. He doesn't want your opinion, or he doesn't really care what you're thinking.
Mm-hmm.
He just said, "This is what you need to do."
Yeah.
I needed that hard coaching.
Right.
I needed hard coaching to tell me exactly what I need to do each day. And he said, "You need to be at an early." And I went to a 6 a.m. meeting in Plainview. A group called Reflections, and we met every single day at 6 a.m. And that's when I started my journey in early morning AA. And I'm a big fan of early morning AA, because I was waking up to untreated alcoholism.
Yeah.
It's untreated.
Yeah.
So I needed to get to that meeting where you literally, during the course of the meeting, you go through a psychic change during the meeting.
Yeah.
So because you walk out of there saying, "Man, I feel a lot better than when I came in here."
It's true. It's incredible.
And so, you know, these little things that happen, they're not so little. These people that I met in AA, the people that came before me, God bless them, because I suffered from terminal uniqueness. You know, "Oh, if you have, you know."
Yeah.
"My issues." And they were like,
"You don't understand me.
You're a garden variety alcoholic, man. Garden variety. You'll get better the way we got better, the same way, doing the work.
Yeah.
Doing these 12 steps." You know, so, you know, get over yourself. And that's the, you know, early sobriety is no joke. No joke. Because I felt like the Tin Man from The Wizard of Oz. I was so stiff and so awkward because I had lived a life under the influence.
Yeah.
Everything was done under the influence. So when I started this journey, I had to learn how to socialize again. I was just very uncomfortable around people. People would invite me to a Yankee game or a Knicks game, and they'd say, "We got tickets for the Knicks." I'd say, "No, I have that thing I have to take care of." I had nothing to take care of.
Right.
The thought of sitting there for the next 3 hours, what am I going to talk about? Well, it's just everything was awkward.
Yeah.
And it took me a good year of intense AA fellowship to start to get comfortable in my own skin. It was like I had new skin and just...
It didn't fit right.
No. It was very, it was a, so people that are new out there, they there's an old line, don't quit before the miracle happens. The miracle's gonna happen. It's going to happen. If you're doing the work, it's almost mathematical. Yeah. 2 + 2 = 4. You keep, you know, those 12 steps lead to progressive recovery. Just like the disease is progressive, so is recovery. Recovery is progressive as well. I can attest to that, and it's my job to testify for that newcomer. It's like going to court. Going to AA in a way is like going to court, because if you haven't had the, you haven't had the spiritual awakening, you haven't the root awakening, follow the evidence. Follow the evidence that's in the big book, that's in the literature, the testimony from people that share at meetings or speak at meetings. You don't have to, don't get too caught up in this, in the spiritual aspect, the whole God thing. God, you know, could stand for a group of drunks.
Yeah.
Good orderly direction. Your life now has starts to take on good orderly direction. You're doing the next right thing. Mm-hmm. Your life has got to get better.
Right.
You know, you remove the alcohol, but you know, it's easier said than done. It's when you're going through it. So my heart goes out to those, to that newcomer, and it's my job to tell them it's going to be okay.
Yeah.
Relax.
It's
going to be okay. You know, have a cup of coffee, you know, to get some coffee, listen to what the speaker has to say. And inevitably they're going to say something that he can identify with, you know?
Yeah.
When I heard about a guy growing up in a neighborhood whose family, you know, you shake my family tree, bottles fall out. I almost fell on the floor laughing because I said, I know what you're talking about.
I love that. You shake my family tree and bottles
fall out. Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Doomed. You know, yeah, just you're doomed. Completely doomed. You know,
but it's incredible. I remember you when my first meeting was an NA meeting, and it was the night before my first AA meeting, and I hated it. I was like, oh my God. I had just arrived in treatment. They said, go to a meeting. I went to a meeting and I left the meeting. It was like 8 p.m. to 9 p.m. And I was like, these are not my people. Nope. If this is what it's going to be like, this is not for me.
Right.
And then I went back to Karen and I said to someone, you know, that wasn't for me. And they said, well, why don't you call this woman Nancy? And she'll pick you up at like 6 a.m. I was like, 6 a.m.? No way. They're like, no, but call her. I was like, okay. And the next day, she picked me up at like 6:15. I was like, what is going on? But it was the best hour probably I had in 20 years, right. You know? Like, I finally felt some hope. I felt like, wow, these are my people. Like, right. I got it. I heard so many nuggets, and none of them were exactly like me, obviously, but I heard some nuggets of how I felt.
Yeah.
Right. People shared how they were feeling, or anecdotes like shaking the family tree, you know? And I just was like, oh my God, I'm here, you know? And the stay, don't leave before the miracle happens. Someone said that, you know? Maybe it was Dean, who knows?
No original thoughts in AA.
Yeah.
It's stuff that was handed down, oral history.
I was like, you know what? I will stay and I'll give it a chance.
Yeah.
And I had my New York attitude, right? Like, right. I'll give it a chance.
Right.
They're lucky to have me.
Yeah.
And if it works, I'll hang out, you know? And it starts to work. Exactly as you said, it's a mathematical equation.
I had another guy say, you know, I came into AA, I had thin skin and a cold heart.
Mm.
And AA gave me thick skin and a warm heart.
Right.
So overly sensitive. How dare you tell me that I have 90 and 90. How dare you tell me I have to do 90? How dare you tell me I have to get a sponsor?
Right.
How dare you? Yeah.
But you got to do it.
Got to get over yourself, Mike.
Yes.
You're not as important as you think you are.
Right.
You know, join the crowd. Get in line with the rest of us. Get in line with the rest of the elephants. And like, we're part of the Dawn Brigade now.
Yeah, exactly. That's great. So what was earlier? So were you back home? Were you living at home?
I was living at home. And I was back home. And, you know, we did end up getting divorced because Randy could see very clearly that I had a different path in life than perhaps what she had imagined for us.
Yeah.
So, and that was another thing. My divorce was very amicable.
That's
so
nice.
I was like, Randy, we're good. You know,
yeah.
we're We're good.
She's like, I put up with you.
She's a good friend now. My ex-wife is a good friend.
Oh, I love
she's
that.
A great mom.
Yeah.
I mean, not a good mom.
But did
a great
she have
mom.
Any rules for you when you came back? Like, hey, if you don't go to these meetings or if you don't do this, or was it soon after you came back? She was like, all right, like, I think that this isn't working.
Yeah, it took about a year. She actually waited. She waited to have that discussion until I was really sober a year, because she couldn't believe it either.
Wow.
She was like, this guy's really, he's really staying sober.
Yeah.
This is unbelievable.
Right.
So she said, I don't want to rock the boat. Let's just wait about a year.
That's great of her.
And, you know, in sobriety, I've made some mistakes. I've made mistakes in relationships. I've made some mistakes legally.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been some real adversity in sobriety, you
right.
know. You know, because you're living life, your life starts to get really busy. And sometimes, you know, you make a mistake and you start putting in place of your actual higher power, money becomes
right,
a higher power.
Right.
Women become a higher power. You know, you start chasing the money and chasing women. You know, I was single.
You're like, my life's back.
Yeah. So, you know, I wanna go have some fun.
Right. And,
but, you know, as like everything else, we take it to such an extreme
yeah.
that it ends up, you know, really backfiring. You know, I do nothing in moderation. Everything is to an extreme. So those are lessons learned. Lessons learned, you know, in life.
Yeah.
And the most important thing was that I did stay. I continued to go to meetings. I stayed fairly close to AA.
Mm-hmm.
But as I've been down here in Florida now 11 years. And Delray Beach, I look at it, is not just a place I moved to. It's almost like a pilgrimage.
Yeah.
Because that town has a culture of recovery. There's
it
a
does.
Culture of recovery there. AA and treatment is very strong down here. I tell the people up north, I say, let me tell you something. The AA is pretty strong down here.
Yeah,
it's
very,
a strong deal
very.
Down here. There's some really solid,
I go back
people.
North. My parents still live up north. I always joke around and say, like, I retired and came to Florida and they stayed up north. I mean, they're, you know, but I work. I have not retired by any means.
Right.
But, you know, I joke around and I go back up to see them. And, like, it's hard sometimes to find a meeting, you know, or it's like midday, like 11 a.m. And I work. I can't just, like, get up and go. So right. it's hard. You know, there's not the opportunities as you have, like, every hour. I mean, there are some places I don't go to, like, Central. Like, there's some places I don't actually go to. Like, I stick to a different place. But if I wanted to go to a meeting, it exists on every hour on the hour
right.
almost.
Right, right.
In a two-mile vicinity, right? So It's pretty incredible.
And they do a big thing with hospitals and institutions down here. I mean, they're really trying to embrace, you know, treatment is discovery. AA is recovery.
Yeah, you know? I love that. That was important to hear because treatment wouldn't have kept me sober.
No.
You know, and also treatment, I was still a mess. Like I was causing havoc.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny because they kicked me out and I'm very involved there now. I'm like on the board of advisors and all this stuff,
right.
but they kicked me out. And what she said to me, she was like, you haven't found it. You haven't. I was like, I do AA. And I was so offended. I was like, I do AA. I go to the morning meeting every single day and I do my steps and I do this and I do that. And she's like, yeah, but you are trying to keep in control of everything. You have not let go. You've done nothing. You've done no work. I was so offended.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, she could not have offended me more. I left. I marched to my halfway house. And my parents were pissed. Everyone was pissed. And I was like, they don't know what they're talking about, you
right.
know?
Mm-hmm.
But it was so important because, like, I hadn't let go. And I hadn't trusted the process was the word she uses.
Yeah.
You're not trusting the process.
Right.
And it's incredible what happens when you, like, go to these meetings. I needed to go. I still went to that meeting every day, but I had to like trust you guys and I had to trust the process and really get into that work.
Yeah.
Right. And yeah. like my first fourth step was 13 resentments, you know, and Nancy just went, are you sure? And I was like, yeah. I was like, oh, I'm so over it. Like, what are you talking about? I'm over it. And she was like, okay. Anyway,
you suffice, do a good imitation of her.
That's suffice to say that I redid my steps again, obviously. And then it was like 8 pages in Excel, front and back. Like, I wasn't joking. Oh, thorough. But also, like, I hated everyone. I was angry and resentful and saying, you know. So it's funny how, you got to get thorough. You got to get deep because otherwise,
you know, we're as sick as our secrets, right?
Yeah.
You know? And like when I finally, I pulled this old timer to the side and I said, listen, man, I don't just drank vodka. It wasn't just vodka that I drank. I also drank Listerine. And he was like, yeah, we know all about that stuff, Mike. You know, that's what drunks do.
Yeah.
That's what we do.
Yeah.
You know, we drink other things besides just alcohol, you know,
because
anything, hopefully anything, you get something to work, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Because things
but
stop
I think,
working.
I thought that was a dirty little secret, you know. And they were all the old timers were like, sit down. I spilled more than you drank.
It's true though. It's true. It's incredible how like everyone always thinks that their, what they did was the worst.
Right. Right.
And I hear some of these fourth steps. She's like, I've never told anyone that, you know, and I'm just like, please. That's nothing.
Right.
I've done way worse.
Yeah.
But that's what's the miracle and the beauty of it, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Is the fact that we identify so much in one another.
Yeah, and you get rid of all of that junk in your trunk.
Yeah.
Just unload all of that junk that you carried. And that's why, you know, the things that happened to me in early childhood, like I told you about the wedding and, you know, the feeling of, you know, being doomed. I had to revisit that stuff, you know, and say, wow, that really affected me at that time. You know, it was really frightening. It was a frightening experience to see adults, you know, out of control. I never forgot that. You know, that wasn't just something that, oh, well, it happened and, you know, it's the past. No, that sort of stuff affected me through life. It's not like PTSD, but I never forgot that, you know, as I've gotten older, you know, and I'm 68 now. That was, you know, I was 6 years old then. So that's 62 years ago.
Right. That's incredible.
Yeah. So.
So you told me, so now early recovery sounds like, you know, going to these meetings, like as if
challenging.
It's, yeah.
It was challenging at first.
So tell me a little bit more about what that was like. And then I want to hear, like, you know, I want you to share with us kind of like what's the difference? What do you do now? What's different?
Well, you know, what I went through early on, as I mentioned, you know, it took time to really kind of settle down in AA. And the fellowship, you know, kind of got me there. You know, having friends in the fellowship and then, you know, it's funny up north, When you have 90 days, they say, okay, you got to speak, which is another frightening thought. You know, speak. What in front of speak in front of people. You know, at the meeting, you're going to speak, but it's almost like a rite of passage up there to do that to help you. You know, again, get more comfortable in your own skin. So you know, but it was methodical. But I would say after a year, as I started to really settle down, it started to, like, recovery started to spread out, you know, the way I treated people, the way I treated my sister, the way I treated my, at the time, ex-wife, my relationship with my daughter, my relationship with coworkers. I mean, people would say to me, you know, on a Monday morning, they'd say, what is it with you Monday morning? You act like it's Friday afternoon. How could you be in such a good mood? Yeah, because I was just at an early morning meeting, you know.
Yeah.
So it affects everything. You know, the recovery has tentacles that go out to every single aspect of your life.
Right.
You know? So not only did I recover, my family recovered because they were damaged goods. I know because I damaged them.
Right.
You know, so they started to recover. And we started, you know, we still do things together as a family. I've been divorced over 20 years. You know, we still do things as a family. When they come down to Florida, my daughter lives up in, she's on West 23rd Street over by the...
Chelsea Piers.
Chelsea Piers, right. She's over there. So she'll come down 4 or 5 times a year. My ex-wife is a snowbird. You know, she'll be down here. I check her mail every day, you know, stuff like that. So, you know, we're
such a good guy.
We're still a family. We're still a family together. We talk on the phone and all of that is, it's all because of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's all because of recovery, a culture of recovery.
That's awesome.
When you first get to AA, you're going to meetings. You're leaving your home and you're going to a meeting. You're going to a meeting, going to see other people. But as time goes on, it's this, you start to develop this feeling that I belong.
Right.
I belong to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a lot bigger than just going to a meeting. It's a culture of recovery.
Right.
You know, you feel like you're part of this fellowship. You know, Taste of Recovery is a big deal. That's coming up in November.
Yeah, very exciting. I love that.
Oddly enough, it's going to be at the Beer Garden. It's a German-American club called the Beer Garden up in Boynton Beach.
West Palm?
No, not before West Palm. But anyway, it's just above Boynton Beach.
Lake Worth.
Lake Worth. Yeah, it's up in Lake Worth.
Took me a second.
Yeah.
Usually they do it on Atlantic. So just...
They changed it was more trouble than it was worth.
Right. Viewers, Taste of Recovery is an event they do down here in Florida.
Right.
It used to be on Atlantic Avenue, which is like a strip, like 42nd Street, let's say, but like...
Kind of like the Jersey Shore.
Right. It's a little strip and it's lots of fun restaurants and all of that. And it would be chefs and people who would take place in it and cook little dishes.
Yeah, well, the restaurants participate.
I've participated a few times, like in buying tickets and stuff, you know.
Right, right.
And... Okay, so this year it's at the Beer Garden. That's kind of funny.
But they do it up. And went, well, for the Taste of Recovery event, it's strictly sober.
You know,
no beer, nothing. Just a live band and, you know, all sorts of food. Tasting and food. And, you know, they all put their best foot forward.
I love that.
And it's fellowship. Yeah. It's fellowship because a lot of people come into AA and they're like, how am I going to have any fun? How am I going to have any fun in sobriety?
That was my biggest question.
Yeah.
I would sit on my little porch smoking my cigarettes, I always say, and I was like, my life is over.
Yeah. Is this it?
How am I going to live?
Right. But you find out there's a huge life.
Oh my God, it's bigger than before. I wasn't living before. How can I consider that living, you know?
Right. And my deal now is that, you know, I love living down here in South Florida. I love Delray Beach and Boca, you know, it's just a great area. I call Boca Raton Long Island with palm trees, you know.
Yeah, it's the same.
Very much, very similar. A heavy, heavy New York accent, you know, down here.
For sure.
A lot of people.
Would you say recovery has been an easy journey?
It's got some peaks and valleys to it. It's not as Paul McCartney said, it's a long and winding road. Mm. You know, it kind of, there's twists and turns because the worst thing to do for me is to project. Well, 6 months from now, this is what I'm going to be doing. You really don't know what you're going to be doing in 6 months, mm-hmm. you know. Hopefully you're still alive, you know, that God, you know, you're grateful for another day of living, right?
Yeah.
And but that takes a lot of training, a lot of work.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of work to keep it in the day.
Yeah.
They have a saying, they say a lot up north, they say, keep your head where your feet are.
Right.
You know, just keep it in the day. Well, easy to say.
It
takes practice.
I used to make a lot of plans and I do like to plan, right?
Right.
I like to plan generally, but even with like my sponsees or my life or whatever, I'm like, on Wednesday, I plan for the week. Don't call me on Monday about my weekend. Don't even mention Friday, Saturday, or Sunday to me.
Yeah.
You know, I can't think that far ahead. I need to just keep it 3 to 4 days ahead of me. You know what I mean? I mean, there are things
manageable.
I plan for, like this podcast, right? I have someone coming in to help and everything. I need to plan different people to come. But typically, I need a 3-day view.
Right.
Four-day view.
To organize properly, sure.
Yeah, but I can't think too far ahead.
Yeah, because projecting, another funny line from up north, they said, you know, you're projecting 6 months, 9 months out. I mean, you know, man plans and God laughs.
Yeah,
you know?
But it's true.
Because you really don't know how the move. One guy said to me, he goes, are you a script writer? I go, what do you mean? Like in Hollywood? He goes, yeah, are you a script writer? He goes, because you seem to know how the movie's going to play out.
Right.
You know? He goes, you really don't know, you know, it's it's God's will, not yours.
Right.
You know, so, but in AA, you know, I've had challenges. There's adversity, but I learned that that's just life, you know?
Yeah.
And I've lived a good life in AA. It's a great life
right.
in AA. Recently, as I've gotten a little older, I've really focused more on the newcomer.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're the most important people in the room. Because they're the ones that are baffled and bewildered, and they're like, what's going to happen to me?
Right.
And it's my job to reassure them. This is the best decision you've ever made in your life. You're saving your life. You're saving your life, especially to now with the fentanyl and everything. It's just
so scary.
It's so frightening.
I remember because I'm not just alcohol, right? I did a lot of drugs.
Right.
And a lot of prescription drugs, you know, I thought it was okay. These doctors right. are giving me these drugs. They're okay.
Right.
But the truth is they're not. And I ended up in AA and people were like, well, why didn't you do NA? And I really felt I belonged in that meeting and I wasn't scolded for talking.
Right.
I mean, eventually you're not talking about alcohol or drugs. You're really talking about living feelings
yeah.
and things
yeah.
like that.
Challenges,
but,
right.
But I know that I mentioned it a few times and I didn't get scolded, which I really loved.
Right.
You
right.
know, I love that. And you're one of the people who is very accepting, I think, of people who are not just alcohol.
Oh, yeah. No.
Because it's not typical.
You know, back in the 80s, you know, when I was dressed like Sonny Crockett from Miami Vice, you know, running around from one club to the other, I did plenty of drugs, you know, I mean. But it was alcohol.
Alcohol
was the thing that really brought me down.
Yeah.
Because, you know, alcohol's cheap compared to, you know, cocaine and, you know.
Other things,
drugs,
yeah.
So, and it's legal. It's legal.
Poisoning your brain is legal.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Liquor stores and bars, you know, you can walk in it, which makes it very dangerous, especially dangerous for people like us.
Yeah.
Because it is legal, you know. But, yeah, AA's just been a lifesaver. And, you know, I love people that are in recovery. Everybody could use an AA program.
Yeah.
Everybody. I have a friend who works at the Boys.
Mm-hmm.
On military,
yeah.
Which is like an insane asylum during the course of the day.
Don't even get me started. I went in there once and I left the cart
yeah.
full in
yeah.
there because I started, it was yeah. early, I was in early yes. recovery and I was like, this is just, I got to get out of here.
It's just a
I was
going
to lose my
right.
marbles.
Right.
I've been back since.
Yeah, yeah. The fights on the deli line are especially, it's like the WWF, you know, they're just they're locked up.
And I'm like, where are you rushing to go to, really?
Right, right. right.
But anyway.
Right. But yeah, no, this has been coming down to Delray Beach. It's been like a pilgrimage, an AA
yeah.
pilgrimage. And because I like the fact that it has that real culture of recovery. It's not just Crossroads and the meetings. And they're always coming up with new ideas for beach, like a beach party. You know,
yeah.
they had a volleyball and
cookout. Oh, yeah, I have a friend
cookout.
Who sends me every full moon, every month, they do a gathering. You know, it's a meeting style. I don't know if it's a real meeting or not, but he invites me every month and it's like, let's watch the full moon and it's on the beach. And it's
right.
really about fellowship. It's
especially
really about,
for the newcomer, you know,
yeah.
you get them out maybe bowling or doing something,
yeah.
you know. And
it's nice. I liked all those things a lot.
I remember another guy from the past, another AA saint, AA angel. He
right.
didn't look like an angel and he didn't speak like an angel, but he was an AA, this guy Andy Bocci. He gave me the Living Sober book. He goes, here, read that. So I started reading. I said, hey Andy, this book's lame, man. This book says take a walk in the park. This book's lame. He goes, no, you're lame. The book is fine. He goes, these are activities to get you off the couch instead of sitting home saying, oh, I can't drink, you know.
Yeah.
Get into go bowling, you know, go shoot some pool, you know,
yeah.
not in a bar, you know.
Yeah.
Do other activities and get out there and live life. And, you know, get it, you know, work, you know, get to work. And, you know, I'm a phone guy, you know,
mm-hmm.
that I've done, sold a lot of things over the phone. And that's why they'd say to me on a Monday morning, what got into you? What are you so happy
yeah,
about? It's
yeah.
Monday morning.
I'm a phone person too. I'm on the phone. I do sales and marketing
right.
and all of that.
Right, right.
Right.
And these are just regular people. These aren't, they're not even, you know, drunks. These are civilians. I call them civilians. They just look at me and they say, it's Monday morning. Why are you in such a...
Yeah, because you're in a good mood.
Because I've had a psychic change.
Yeah.
And that psychic change is gonna happen for anybody, everyone who does the work, who does take it serious about those 12 steps.
Yeah.
And it will lead you to, you know, it leads you to a second life, reborn.
That's how I feel. I feel like this is the bonus round. I got really lucky.
No doubt about it. That's why I wake up each day grateful for another day. And you know, when I heard someone else say that, I'm grateful for another day of living. I was like, pretty dramatic, don't you think, pal? You know. But as I've gotten older, I'm like, you know,
yeah,
I get it. You know, I'm grateful for another day sober and no surprises in the mail, you know, no certified mail.
Oh my God, know? I hated that mail. I tried to, I'll never forget, I got in trouble and I was living with my parents and I forwarded the mail, my mail. I thought I forwarded my mail. I found out that I forwarded everybody's mail. And the only things that were coming to the house was the court mail.
Right.
So I actually like put a spotlight on it. Like I was trying to like get around, you know, get around it.
Right.
Didn't want my parents to find out.
Of course not.
And my dad's like, where the hell is my mail? He still has a fax. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So he's like, where is my mail? That's how he pays his bills.
Right. He's still writing checks. Right?
I was in so much trouble. You know, they didn't even, at that point, my dad cared more about me forwarding my mail than he did about what happened. He's like, I don't even care. You're in trouble. You're an adult. You figure it out.
Right,
you know,
right,
I'm not getting you a lawyer. I'm not doing anything.
Right.
Anyway, so that's really funny. But, oh my God. So, I mean, you're like the happiest person I know.
Yeah. I just love life and, you know, it's just been a great journey.
Yeah.
But great journey.
No more picking up dry cleaning and groceries and
faking
it.
Yeah, trying to perpetuate a fraud.
Yeah.
It was fraudulent, you know.
Right.
And it's just, you know, AA makes you a genuine person.
It does.
Recovery makes you genuine.
People,
because you're not afraid anymore. You're not trying, you're not hiding anything. It's a, this is me, warts and all. This is what I am, you know.
Yeah.
And you know what? It's good. It's all good, you know. And then we have this awesome fellowship that we belong to. So I love seeing new people. I love seeing the light go on.
Yeah.
Where they say, wow, this...
Isn't it cool when you see the actual change and you're like, holy, and it is, it's watching, like, that's why I love working with someone who's new.
Yeah.
And I love seeing that change. And I'm like, you are a totally different person than you were when I first met you. When I first met you, it was like doomsday.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Doomed.
Doomed. And now it's like you love life. It's
right.
Embracing life.
It's a new lease on life, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I say to them, welcome to the Magic Kingdom. The Magic Kingdom is not in Orlando. It's here in Delray Beach.
Right. That's so cool. I love that.
And it's just a great way to live, you know, for anybody and everybody who is willing to grab hold of our hand.
Yeah.
Take
absolutely.
Our hand and join us on this journey, shoulder to shoulder, arm in arm.
Yep.
You know?
So I ask everyone when they come on the show, if you could tell your younger self something, what age would it be? And what would you tell your younger self?
And, you know, I had a similar question come up on Facebook.
Okay.
If you could speak to your younger self. They said, you have to keep it to four words though.
Oh, okay.
If you were talking to your
younger
self.
I think I saw this.
And I said, I wrote down, some people say, oh, stay in school or, you know, whatever. And I said, don't drink alcohol ever. Like ever, you know.
Yeah,
Don't drink alcohol ever.
Right.
And that would be my message to myself because you're depriving yourself of such a great life. But this is a sneaky, sneaky disease, you know? It's insidious, you know?
Mm-hmm.
The way it just kind of creeps into your life because it all starts out so innocent.
Right.
Just a few beers. It's us and Jethro Tull and Zeppelin and Black Sabbath just hanging out.
Yeah.
You know, having a good time. High school dance.
Right.
There's no way I was going to a high school dance unless I'm pretty under the influence.
Yeah.
Because I'd ask my friends, what are we doing tonight? Well, we're going to go up to Mount St. Ursula. We're going to ask these chicks to dance. What?
Right.
Not like this, I'm not.
Yeah.
So even at, you know, at like 16, it was just, it was already
something dependent. So you'd be what, 14?
14 when that one.
And you tell yourself, don't drink ever.
Don't drink alcohol ever. Don't drink alcohol like ever.
Okay. But do you regret anything?
What's that?
Do you have any regrets?
No, I don't. I had to drink every drink. I left I felt like I left no stone unturned, you know, and that has made my gratitude and faith in AA that much greater. Mm-hmm. You know, my faith is strong in AA, and I'm passionate about sober living, and the newcomer gets the benefit of that. Yeah. You know, like I can save you. Like a young person who's like, whatever, 25 years old, I can save you a lot of time and grief.
Yeah.
You know, but grab hold of this and you will have an unbelievable, a life beyond your wildest dreams.
It's true. And it's true. Yeah. It really is. I think that I really started living when I did the work, you know, that first year was hard.
Yeah.
You know, let's not sugarcoat it.
Right.
It's hard.
No, it's hard.
And it continues to be hard sometimes, but then something happens and it's like you're coasting.
Yeah.
It's like, this is good.
Things are
even on
smooth.
The bumps, it's good.
Yeah.
You know?
You can, and I'm grateful for the adversity because there's another line in AA, if God takes you to it, he'll take you through it.
And I've never heard that one, actually.
And that's true. That's a true statement. You know, I had a serious legal issue back in 2004. It was a.
You were sober.
I was sober.
Yeah.
I was sober, and it was. This was a federal issue.
Wow.
You know, it was a white collar thing, but you know, I thought I was. Thought I made a huge mistake. I did make a huge mistake, but again, you know, judges love AA.
Yeah. And
when
they
look at a sentencing report, pre-sentencing report, I remember the judge looking at my pre-sentencing report. He goes, "Wait a second. Says here you go to a 6 a.m. AA meeting? I go, yes, Your Honor. Every day? Yes, Your Honor. That's remarkable. I still have to punish you, but it's remarkable.
Right.
I mean, I got like a 90-day house arrest type of thing, but it could have been a lot worse.
Okay. Well, you'll tell me what it was later.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming.
Well, I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Good. Well, can we hug? Is that okay?
Absolutely. Yes. All right, great. Yes.